interested in the time at Columbia. Your beginning work with Richard Porter.
Mm-hmm.
How did you hear about Richard Porter's work to have him come join you as a postdoc at Columbia?
Well, he was actually a graduate student at the University of Illinois and worked with Fred Wall. actually did some trajectory calculations of H plus H2 in a linear collision and using a potential surface that was not very good. But no, I met him, we talked a lot, and so I invited him to come to Columbia when he finished his degree as a postdoc.
How did the work that became semi-empirical and the quantum calculated for the 3D H2 trajectories come into play? How did you come up with that work together?
Well, the H plus H2, this was, the simplest possible chemical reaction. And there were, again, sort of, why was this a good time to do it? And there were a number of reasons. One was that there were good experiments on the reaction as a function of temperature, so it knew something about the activation barrier and other things. And secondly, there was the beginning of the molecular beam work of Taylor and Dotz, and who actually worked for an H plus H2. And so that rather than just measuring the overall reaction, you could measure the reaction as a function of the system energy in a single collision. So rather than having all the averaging of Avogadro's number undergoing the reaction, which would hide a lot, you could actually find how the reaction varied with the collision energy that was put in. So there was the possibility of getting much more detailed information, which, if you had a detailed calculation, they would basically complement each other. I mean, they could essentially measure what happened in a single collision, and we could calculate what would happen in a single collision. That was the idea. Now, the sort of the jump was that we realized or believed that just using classical mechanics, even for these very light atoms, as I mentioned, I guess later on when we started talking, when I mentioned molecular dynamics, would work for it. I mean, there was some, I mean, people had done, well, not really, so, no. I mean, there was really no very good evidence that classical mechanics was good enough for just doing the trajectories, looking at the motions. And there were some arguments, but they were sort of crude arguments, so it was basically just going ahead and trying to see where they would work. But to do the calculation, when you needed some surface on which the atoms moved, which essentially, if you know how the energy varies with distance, you can get the forces on the atoms. And all that had previously been done, it used a very inaccurate surface. And so the first thing that we did was to develop this, what then became called the Porter-Karklis surface, which was used, a little bit about various things that we talked about, putting in some empirical information and sort of combining it with quantum mechanical rules, essentially, to be able to get a surface. And one knew the barrier height pretty well from some of these experiments, and so we could adjust the surface to be what we thought was a good representation of what actually happened. It was only some years later that people could do a full quantum mechanical calculation that was accurate enough so that the trajectories would be meaningful. So there were these two parts, and Dick Porter worked on both of them, so he was very important. And then on the trajectories, there was also Ramesh Schrammer, who mainly sort of played the role of doing a lot of the calculations once things were set up. And it wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have the 650 at the Watson Lab
to calculate.
And it was really very exciting to do this, and it was only about, it must have been almost 10 years later that a full quantum mechanical calculation was done, one of them by Aaron Cooperman, actually, which showed that our results with this classical method, which we took probably a thousandth of the time, was very accurate. And there was only one thing that we did that was special, and that, you know, if the system were quantized, then a molecule would have a number of vibrational energy levels. And the hydrogen molecule, since it has a very strong bond, has very largely spaced energy levels. And so one knows it's in the ground, the lowest energy level, and we actually put in that energy, which as the system reacts, the bond strength varies, and it becomes available for the reaction. That's what we call the quasi-classical method. And that was a very important part of making things work. Why it worked exactly is more complex, but happened, then George Schatz wrote an article. There was this, the most important papers I guess since the beginning of the Journal of Chemical Physics, referred to this paper, and the method that we use, this quasi-classical method, he said that it's still very, very useful because it makes the calculation much, much faster, but does give accurate results. So,
and you and Richard Porter, you and Dick Porter later wrote a textbook together. You later wrote the textbook together,
right,
Atoms
right.
and Molecules.
Yeah, actually what happened is that we taught course together. I mean, he came up to Harvard as a visiting lecturer or whatever, and taught part of a physical chemistry course. And then we wrote this book over a long period of time.
After you had transferred to Harvard.
Right, yeah.
So take us from that transition. You were at Columbia, you had your five-year plan,
mm-hmm.
you were approaching your 5 years in 1965. What were your thoughts about the next step?
Well, I was up for a sabbatical, and I was trying to think where to go. And then I let people know that I was thinking of leaving Columbia, and I got, I don't know, 20 offers. So, and including Caltech, Berkeley, Chicago, various other places, and sort of tried to narrow things down. And finally, I spent 6 months in Berkeley and 6 months at Harvard. I've forgotten why I decided I wasn't interested in Caltech, but decided to come to Harvard. Now, why did I decide to come to Harvard? One, probably that I'd been at Harvard. That's always an attraction. And, you know, and it's a very good place, and particularly it has very good students. So does Berkeley. But to me at that time, Berkeley had a long tradition, going back to G.N. Lewis, that, you know, in chemistry you didn't need theoreticians, that experimental chemists could do their own theory. And so beginning, things were just changing a little bit. And a good friend, Robert Harris, who was actually my first undergraduate student at Illinois, who was on the faculty there. And there was, but I sort of also had this feeling that it was relatively sleepy, that people were more interested in their ranches and such than in doing science, even though they were very bright people. And so I decided that Harvard was the better place to be, and I think it was a good decision, though Berkeley now is much better than it used to be and has some really outstanding people like David Chandler and Bill Miller and such. Some of whom, well, Bill Miller was here as a junior fellow. We actually worked together for a while.
When you went out to spend part of that sabbatical at Berkeley in mm-hmm. California, this was 65, 66. It's a pretty socially active time,
right?
Especially in Oakland with the anti-war protests.
Yeah.
What are some of your memories of that time?
I mean, I was very much involved in some of the protests, and actually, I got in some of the cases where, you know, students were marching peacefully against the Vietnam War, and the police came in and was knocking them down and such, and I took a lot of pictures of it, and I gave them to a newspaper, but then I don't know, they disappeared, and I didn't have copies of them, unfortunately. But it was really, I never personally got hurt or anything, but it was a lively time. And Bob Harris was also a very liberal person, more so than I, and was a lot involved. And, you know, and there were the rallies on campus and the student nonviolent movement, which wanted to be nonviolent. And I didn't, you know, since I was not really a member of the faculty, I didn't sort of have a direct connection with trying to persuade the university, you know, not to collaborate with the police and let the people gather. At a certain point, they were chased off, and again, there was a fairly violent interact that took place. Mm-hmm. But
when you chose Harvard, what was the political atmosphere here? This is still a pretty active anti-war movement in Boston.
That's right. There also was that, and there were various. There were a couple of sit-ins in chemistry, tried to get them not involved in the war activities. And an interesting thing is Bob Woodward, who is pretty conservative, turned out that his daughter was one of the people in the sit-ins. So he, you know, worked hard to persuade the administration to let the students, you know, sit here and for a certain amount of time, and let them get out. And also, because Pusey was president at the time, and there was a big meeting again in terms of whether the police should be allowed to come in, and I guess the students were in University Hall, and I remember at that meeting I was part of the negotiators with Pusey to just take it easy and not call in the police, and give the students 24 hours to sort of leave and give a, you know, a peaceful protest march and then get out, which did work out. But it was really very uncertain what exactly, I mean, it was sort of very unclear whether this would work or not, whether Pusey would really go along with it. I mean, his feeling was that he probably should call in the outside police and not just have the campus police sort of patrolling and making sure peaceful. But it was an exciting time, and they are, you know, as a faculty member, I played much more of a role.
Who are some of the other faculty? Who are some of the other faculty involved in this work? Anyone here or at MIT? Or?
At MIT, I don't really know. And well, I mean, I guess Zinn, the BU, was very actively involved, and
the people that you had contact with.
Yeah, Mendelsohn, who, history professor, were involved. I mean, a number of them were. It was an exciting time, not a very good time for doing research, but
in terms of the research, you were eventually found a shift to move your traditional work in chemistry over these past years and return to your original love in biology. How did you go about that transition?
Let me say, sort of at various times in my life, I've thought of doing something or other that was very different. And having a sizable research group and being able to sort of stay on top of everything that was going on and having things going on, continuing to publish papers, gives you the luxury of spending a significant part of your time on looking at something new. And so what happened is that a book was published in honor of Linus Pauling. I don't remember exactly what birthday. It's probably around somewhere, but I had an article in it which was a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It was about chemical reactions, but I pointed out it was very important to know the structure and the energy and such, and Pauling wasn't that much interested in dynamics. He was much more a structural person, but I had this article, it was a review. But then while I was looking at it when it first came out, I noticed that George Wald and Ruth Hubbard had an article about vision and retinal. And I looked at it and I realized that the understanding of retinal and its isomerization really hadn't much advanced since the time I was an undergraduate. And because it is a conjugated polymer, conjugated molecule, it's really an ideal molecule to use the type of methods that Coulson, and Parasipar, and Popel had used simplified methods for studying molecules of this type. I mean, I had learned that much when I was with Coulson, though I hadn't done anything. And so I realized that one could really look at the problem of the initial event in vision, which is the isomerization of 11 cis retinal to all trans, and so Barry Honig came, and he had a good theoretical background, and so we basically developed or applied this Parasipar-Popel method for calculating the isomerization barrier and the mixed sort of quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, and this mixture is one of the things that supposedly the Nobel Prize was given for. Though from my point of view, it was really given, it wouldn't have happened if molecular dynamics hadn't been developed to have this interest in, but anyway, that maybe comes later. And so we did this calculation and thought it was very interesting because it gave considerable insight into the mechanism of vision. And so we submitted it to Nature. In those days, it wasn't quite as it is nowadays that you must publish in Nature, Science, or PNAS, or otherwise nobody will look at your paper, or it doesn't count for you. I mean, now it's really pretty terrible, but we did submit it to Nature and immediately got a letter back saying there's no experimental data that prove that your calculation is correct. And so, you know, I was furious, I guess is the only thing to say, and I called up, well, I mean, my idea was, okay, if the experimental data is there, that exists, then there's no, we're not making a prediction, so what's the point? Even though many theoreticians call it predictions when they're in fact just finding they get agreement with the experiment, and then they can get more insight. And so I called up John Maddox, who was the editor, and talked with him for about, I don't know, it must have been 3/4 of an hour or more, and finally convinced him that he ought to publish it, which he did. And then fortunately, about 3 or 4 months later, I don't remember that, a crystal structure came out which confirmed what we had really predicted. So, I mean, that was sort of the beginning of using these mixed classical quantum mechanical calculations.
Where did Barry Honig come from?
Well, he came from Israel. He had worked with Joshua Jordan, who was a very outstanding theoretician there. I think he was born in New York.
Mm. And but for your contact. You also went to Israel in 1968 or so, is that about right?
Yeah.
What was that experience?
Well, this was, I mean, that was somewhat later.
Mm. Oh.
And it basically was, well, I went there for one, to have some time free to think about things, biological things, and the other was to finish Atoms and Molecules, which was in the proof stage, and as I said, like just like with journal articles, you're supposed to just correct little things in the proof, but my habit is to partly rewrite the proof, then you have to get a second proof and such. And so I did spend a lot of time rewriting Atoms and Molecules. But I also was part of the group of Schneer-Lifson, who was one of the pioneers who came, you know, from a European background to Israel and was at the Weizmann Institute, and had a group which included, at the time I was there, Ari Vachel was there, Michael Levitt, the two other Nobel Prize winners, where he was not there then. But what was important for me was that Chris Anfinson, who sort of regularly visited, came to the Weizmann Institute and gave a lecture about protein folding. And he showed this movie, which was a cartoon of myoglobin, which sort of starts unfolded and then forms helices, and those helices come together to form the protein. And I asked him whether you know, what the basis was for this cartoon. He said, well, it's just a cartoon. And then when I came back from Israel, well, even when I was talking to him, I said, well, we can take this model and put in some empirical parameters and use it actually as a model to calculate the rate of folding if it follows a mechanism like that. And David Weaver, who is was a physics professor at Tufts, took a sabbatical and wanted to learn about biology and came over to work with me.
In Israel? In Israel?
No, back at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said, look, we have this mechanism. We have to just calculate how the helices diffuse with each other and what their binding energy is. And with a few parameters, we can actually estimate the rate of folding. And so this was although people had talked about models like this, this was the first time that there was a model of protein folding where you made predictions as to what the rate of folding would be. Though it was only about, I don't know, quite a few years later that the experiments were done to actually be able to check that our model was correct.
And this all started from a cartoon that you saw.
Yeah, also.
That's wild. So this film, this is something we hadn't talked about before, but you also had an earlier interest in film while you were in Caltech, searching through old silent movies and hosting kind of showings.
Right, yeah, before, I mean, I and a couple of other people together with me formed the Film Society, where we showed movies for relatively low price, and the two things were nice, that for these silent movies, one of the other graduate students, named Hamilton, actually, was a good pianist, and so he would make up the musical score for them. You know, he just watched them and make up the score, and it's sort of amazing that somehow your mind takes this score and makes it work very well for the film. And really, some of the things he did were great. I mean, the other thing was that, I went around to different movie studios and see whether they were willing to let us have some films relatively inexpensively. And one of the studios I went to was the Chaplin Studio. And I came in and talked with the secretary and told her, you know, I was a student at Caltech and all this, and she was not very interested. I was just about ready to chase me out when Charlie Chaplin walked in. First vision of him is how little he was, really. But so he asked, well, what's going on? And so she told him, and then he talked with me, and he thought, oh, that's really great that, you know, the young scientist should be interested in seeing some of his films. And so I said, could we have Monsieur Verdoux, which was not being shown in the U.S., and he said, I can't let you do that because it's not approved to be shown. But he did give us a number of the cartoons, some of the classic cartoons. So that was a great experience, and I still remember it.
I find it fascinating that the role of seeing and visualizing, and that it's played both in your scientific career and your outside pursuits, mm-hmm. with photography, with these film work, with seeing the protein folding film, and then that folding back into the model building mm-hmm. you've done. So I'm wondering if that's something that role of visualizing, the role of seeing the model in action, if there's any relationship between your film work, your bird watching, and the molecular dynamic work you end up doing.
Well, I mean, people have asked me how I could take pictures that are really, you know, outstanding photographs without any education and without any experience. And one aspect of many of these films is that they capture some sort of, Cartier-Bresson would call it the decisive moment, but they capture something which is really very striking and preserves it. And I have said, and I think it's probably true, but bird watching actually was very important in being able to do that, because when you are out watching birds and it's leafy trees and everything, you see something or other moving, but you don't really know what it is, and you won't know what it is until you take your binoculars and focus it on them. And you have to be able to do that, with sort of intuitively, that you know where to look, because you can't see the bird when you're actually doing it. And this ability to focus very quickly, I think, played a role in my photography. And there's, of course, another thing which we talked about it last time very early, and the microscope, and looking through the microscope and seeing these rotifers moving around. So I've always been very visually conscious and very visually interested. So I think there is some unity in it. I mean, how much I'd have to have a psychiatrist go in detail, but it does make some sense. So
that experience of the work that you did in Israel, or were exposed to there, and then brought back to really continue the work here at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that came out of that as well is a continued work with Marshall. You invited him to come have a postdoc with you.
Right.
What came out of that work together here at Harvard?
Well,
it spur?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, I had done this work with Barry Honig. And
on the retinal?
On the retinal.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, with R.A. Marshall, we developed a much more detailed program, which sort of could take account of the vibrational motion, the idea is that that for the framework part of the system, you can represent it just by using classical standard vibrational analysis from experiment. And then the quantum mechanical part, which is in the pi electron system, you treat by one or another quantum mechanical model. And I'm not sure I'm being very clear, but RA introduced this sort of more detailed description of the classical part using experimental data such, and so that you could calculate the transition probabilities and in fact the vibrational spectrum and such, which played a role also in developing the potentials, the classical potentials used for the molecular dynamics calculation. And some of this he had learned when he was working with Schneer Lifson, who was one of the early people to develop what's called the consistent force field approach, which is somehow, rather than doing a vibrational measuring the spectrum, fitting it with vibrational force field for a particular molecule, includes effects which should make this force field more universal. And that's sort of the what's special about what they developed, and then we continued to develop here, and Bruce Gellin, who wrote basically our program, which finally became the CHARM program, was really responsible for doing that.
What was Bruce's role, Bruce Gellin's role in that? Where did he come from, how did he join your group and then start doing this work?
I don't remember where he was an undergraduate, but he came as a graduate student to Harvard. And when he first came, he worked on quantum mechanics of very simple systems. The helium molecule and such. And then he was drafted into the army and worked in the lab, because he was a chemist, on LSD and studying. LSD has two conformations, sort of like retinal, and one is active and one is inactive, and sort of studying its properties. And then he got very interested in the biological effects of LSD. And when he came back, he said, look, I don't want to work on helium anymore. I was working with Neil Ostlund. I want to do something related to biology. And so he's the person who essentially developed our version of the force field, which forms the basis of the CHARM program. And then that was really a very essential contribution.
To run the calculations on that pre-CHARM program, was that still being done all the way down in Colombia?
I think that was done, well, the initial calculations were done here by then. Things had improved here.
The computering here in Harvard?
Yeah. And though the big next step was, in fact, to introduce the dynamics, which was done by Andy McCammon. But now we're in sort of the mid-70s. And I had spent a sabbatical in France, and a number of people, Bruce Gellin had gone with me, David Case and others. Andy McCammon, actually, although he was a graduate student here, when I went, because of his wife had a job, she's an MD, went to work with John Deutsch at MIT, and then came back to Harvard and got his degree from Harvard, though he had worked with him, and then came back as a postdoc when I came back from Europe. And we had the idea of taking the program that Bruce Gellin had written to find the forces on the atom, which he had applied to hemoglobin, but there was no, and actually give the atoms kinetic energy. And that's what began molecular dynamics.
So Bruce's initial work on that was actually focused on hemoglobin?
Well, that was the system we were interested in. I mean, we had worked on hemoglobin for a while and had developed a model of it, which goes back to 1971, when Perutz came to MIT and gave a talk on hemoglobin and the mechanism of hemoglobin, essentially. Hemoglobin has a structure when it has oxygen and another one when it doesn't have oxygen. And for the first time, he had been able to determine the oxygenated structure. It had been easy to determine, but the structure where there wasn't any oxygen is less stable. So he finally had determined the structure of that. And looking at the two of them, he made some suggestions how it works from one to the other and what was important for it. And I heard the lecture. I think Alex Rich, who organized the lecture, told me, well, you should come over, it'll be interesting. And so after the lecture, Perutz was sitting in Alex's office, and Alex invited me to talk with him. And Perutz was sitting there eating a banana, which, because he had a lot of stomach problem, he could almost hardly eat anything. Back problem and stomach problem. He was really an amazing individual. In spite of that, he would stand for hours listening to other people's lectures and such. And so, very similar to Anfinsen, well, I guess it was before, but no, it was after, I asked him whether he had tried to actually make these ideas that he gave quantitative. And he said no, and said, that sounds very interesting. I'm not sure he understood quite what I was talking about, but anyway, he was very positive about it. And then when I came back from MIT to Harvard, Attila Szabo had just started working with me as a graduate student. And I said, look, you know, we have a mechanism here. All we have to put in is a few parameters and we can apply it. And Attila, you know, was very, very bright. He's at the NIH and has been there for quite a while. Basically developed the model very quickly, and we published this model about hemoglobin, which has a number of results that people that sort of went against the doctrine about hemoglobin. It's a detailed thing, but I mean, we were able to publish the article. I mean, there was sort of one story that's interesting is that we tried to estimate various parameters that go into the model, and we got some results which looked sort of like the experimental results, but we're not really right on top of them. And so I talked with, there were two people, John Edsel, whom you might have interviewed, I don't know, the biology, he was a
I can't recall.
Yeah, yeah. And Guido Guidotti, who were both in the biology department here and have worked on hemoglobin for a long time. And I talked to them about hemoglobin, like asking them, well, there are these two experiments which disagree. Which one should I believe? And in this particular case, he said, look, your results are nice, but if you publish them and they don't really agree with the experiment, biologists, you know, won't be interested in them. And so we sort of said, okay, we will fit the parameters to experiment, and then we will say, you know, why the values that we chose are physically reasonable, that we can give sort of a range and did this. And then the paper, well, had mixed reception because it violated the doctrine about hemoglobin that the cooperativity parameter is independent of oxygenation, which it can't be. And then finally, experiments were done which showed that it isn't. But the hemoglobin crowd was sort of a very closed group of people. But anyway, so that was. And then after Attila made this model, it became clear that there were some questions that arose about the detailed atomic motions, structural changes in going from one structure to another. And that's when Bruce Gellin applied the potential he had developed to hemoglobin. But it was without any dynamics, it was just minimization. And then basically it was when Andy McCammon came back from France and he came back from MIT as a postdoc that we first did the first molecular dynamics calculation on the BPTI.
Why not continue the work with the hemoglobin?
It's too big. Mm. I mean, you know, BPTI has 500 atoms. Hemoglobin has 4 subunits, each of which have 1,500 atoms. And then, you know, to really do things right, you have to surround it by a box of water. And it's actually true that at this very moment, somebody who was a postdoc with me in Strasbourg is doing simulations of the whole hemoglobin tetramer. and that we're working together on, because there are some questions about how all things work. But now that you can really do this rather than sort of simplifying, making a model, that's what's going on. And there's some things that are very exciting, which, well, we'll see. I'm not sure whether it will work out or not.
Who is that you're working with?
It's Marcus Mühle, who I've published a number of papers with when he was in Strasbourg, and now he's in Basel. Hmm. He's actually going to be coming here next week to discuss the work. So it goes on. I mean, yeah. Hemoglobin, I don't know, every 5 years or so reappears in my life. We also did another study, Weishan Zeng did, on the Bohr effect in hemoglobin, which sort of interestingly goes back to one of the suggestions that Perutz made, which many people said weren't correct. And then we were able to there do a calculation which shows that the salt bridge strengths play the role that he suggested. So that's so it's sort of interesting the way one goes back and can do things a little bit better and such. Hmm. So how are we doing?
We can go for a little bit longer. I'm not sure if you had mentioned this already. What years were your daughters born?
63 and 65.
63 and 65, okay. Sorry, I just wasn't sure if we had.
No, I don't think I mentioned it.
Okay.
So at Columbia in New York.
Yeah. Right.
So the work that turned into molecular dynamics seems to have begun in that late 60s period before your sabbatical and time in Paris, time in France, and then gets picked up again and becomes really dynamic at that after you've returned to from Paris.
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, the two part, dynamics of small systems like the H plus H2 that I mentioned, that was done in the 60s, 64. And then, you know, we continued to do calculations on that. And I said those calculations were partly stimulated by the fact that you could treat individual molecule collisions. What's easy to do on the computer, harder to do experimentally, and was done by the molecular beam things. But then we continued these calculations by averaging over the normal conditions, kinetic energy and such in a normal solvent, and averaging over a lot of molecules to actually find the macroscopic results that you measure by just measuring the rate as a function of temperature in solution. And K.G. Murakumo was one of the people, and Lee Peterson, who worked on that. And then we did two hydrogen molecules colliding and exchanging atoms, a number of simple systems, dynamics over a number of years before actually saying, okay, well, let's try to do this for something like a protein, which happened, you know, basically about 10 years after the H plus H2 calculation, the BPTI calculation was done. And there, I mean, it couldn't be done on the computers. We had a VAX in here, and it just wasn't big enough. But in France at the time, there were workshops on different topics related to using computers in chemistry, because they had what was then a very big computer, a CDC 1600 or something, which was much better than anything that was accessible here. And so somebody named Carl Moser organized these workshops and invited people from all over. And there was one workshop in 1976 that had to do with, the idea was protein dynamics, but nobody actually had any idea what to do. It was just the name of the workshop. But we knew that there we would have access to a big computer. So we worked very hard before that time, Bruce Gellin and Andy McCammon and I, to have a program that could do the BBTI calculation. So as one says, we could hit the ground running, and as soon as we arrived in Saclay outside of Paris, we could start our calculation. And it was only reason because we had access to this computer that we were able to do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually the calculation was done in France. And it's only much later that, you know, the NSF started their computing centers here and such. And unless you had some sort of government relations that you could do it at Livermore or somewhere, it was very hard to get any very near the computer time.
Did you build physical models after running the calculations and having these theoretical
models? We made drawings, but the paper is that shows the dynamics really just has one figure which shows the structure, and not all the atoms, but just the amino acids. There are 54 amino acids. So it's at the initial stage, and after, I don't know, 3.7 picoseconds, and the whole simulation was 9.2 picoseconds, which if you wanted to publish a paper nowadays and said you had done 10 picoseconds, you would be laughed out of the hall. On the other hand, it turns out that many of the things that we concluded from doing this very short simulation, including some sort of lucky accidents that happened, gave insights in the type of motions that are still true today as they were then. And nowadays, David Shaw, does that mean something to you?
Yeah, the Anton computer and the Desmond program.
Right, right. He has this institute where, it's officially a company, where they do very long calculations. And they have now done a calculation of BPTI that's, I think, 1 millisecond.
Millisecond long.
Yeah, and it took them a long time. But you see a little bit more, the fluctuations over the time are a little bit larger and such. But qualitatively, I would say that the insights that you get from that are really not that important. Now, where it becomes more important is, you know, BPTI doesn't do anything. It's a bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, it's called, because it's known that it binds to trypsin and inhibits trypsin. But it's not known whether that's a biological function or not. So it's really a very uninteresting molecule, and its motions don't do very much. I mean, in other enzymes that undergo large conformational changes between active and inactive forms, the simulations are much more important, and then being able to do these longer simulations plays a real role. But in sort of the basic dynamics, also we didn't have any water around, and the proteins are insolvent. So that changes things a little bit.
So let's take back to the transition to Paris. What was the impetus to get back to Europe?
Well, it was, you know, partly my more or less 5-year plan. I thought I would go there permanently. And I liked the idea of living in Europe. I thought, you know, the lifestyle in Europe was more humane than here, where people were. I mean, I did like to work hard, but I also liked, you know, to take really time off, and I liked, you know, the culture there. As I mentioned, the theater, though it's good in New York, but nothing like it's in London and also in Paris with the Comédie Française. So it was just life
Had you improved your French since going to that restaurant?
Well, that's the answer is by the time decided to go there, possibly permanently, the answer is yes, because every sabbatical I had spent in France, mainly in Paris,
mm-hmm.
and when I was at various institutes that I worked, basically, I told people if they wanted to talk to me, they had to talk in French.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, you know, they spoke better English than I spoke French. But in those days, the French didn't speak even the scientists, such good English. So after a relatively short while, it was easier to speak in French.
Mm-hmm.
And was essentially, that was about probably 90% of my education was just doing orally, learning it. Then I also went to the Alliance Française, and so there was a difference between Marcy and me was that she didn't really have this sort of outside possibility to talk French, so it was much harder for her. I mean, she'd go to the market and things like that, but she didn't, I guess, never join any sort of groups, you know, where people spoke French for a few hours,
mm-hmm.
but basically that's how I learned, and so my oral French is much better than my written French.
Mm-hmm. Did you, when you were on these sabbaticals leading up to the time in France, did your daughters join you when you were over there, or did they stay in the States?
Some of both.
Some of both, okay. I mean,
depending where they were, yeah.
Because I think earlier today you had mentioned being on, I forget if it was an NSF panel that focused on elementary education.
Right.
I wasn't sure, I mean, we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about your family, but I'm always curious to know, you know, your daughters became physicians. I'm curious to know, you know, did they come to lab with dad and do things? Were you introducing them to science at the level that you were doing it? Did you try to, you know, look at their science homework when when they were bringing it home and work on that? Like, I'm curious what sort of, if there was any involvement.
Certainly, I think they almost never came to the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't clear whether both would actually become physicians.
Mm-hmm.
One went to Brown as an undergraduate, was much more interested in writing, and somehow when she graduated, she thought of going to Iowa to the writer's workshop mm-hmm. there, but they said, well, maybe I should also apply for something that could give me a career where I could earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
And so she applied to medical school, I mean, to Tufts and Harvard, and she said, well, if I'll get in, I'll do that. Otherwise, I'll go off to Iowa or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Okay.
And my other daughter, Reba, the older one, actually was very much interested in history and studied history when she was at Cornell. And there she lived in a house run, a Jewish house, and we are Jewish, yeah,
mm-hmm.
in a Jewish house, and became interested in visiting Israel, and decided, well, she'd like to do her PhD in history there, but history in Israel is a very narrow subject. I mean, you can study Masada, or something like that, and she decided that's not really, I mean, you know, to pick out, you know, when so-and-so, you know, we're able to climb up, or, I mean, it really is so focused, and so she started working, and she took a job working with autistic children, and she's very lively, much more so than her sister, and very outgoing, and she was very good at working with the autistic children, but it's a terrific drain.
Mm-hmm.
They become very dependent on you when you sort of have to do. So she decided, well, she couldn't really do that as a career, so she decided to go to medical school to sort of be able to work on the, you know, with them, but more on the medical part rather than on the caretaker part. And that's how she got into medical school. And now actually, Tammy is a rheumatologist, and Reba works on infectious diseases. So both sort of moved. It's good to have a rheumatologist in the family. And they, a couple of times when we were in Paris, they were with us, and then they had graduated and gone to college. But then Reba actually was in Paris. Was when the year that Misha was born. He was actually born in Paris, and our son.
What year was that?
81.
81.
And Reba had finished high school, so she was just listening to some courses at one of the schools, Henri Quatre. And Tammy actually took her last year, I guess, at Henri Quatre. And she had great trouble with her English course because she was the English teacher knew only English. And it was really, French education has some good elements. I mean, Misha got his bachelor in baccalaureate in France, and it's very rigorous and very strict. And there's the right answer and the wrong answer, in contrast to American element. And so I think somehow the combination of spending a year there and spending a year here or whatever is really a good way of doing things. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's a good place to stop.
I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about the summers in the Alps. What that time meant for you, for your scientific work, and for your family. The role that the nature seems to come up again.
When it was in Europe in the 1950s, traveling around, I also visited this area, partly because there was a famous restaurant there called Père Bise, which is a 3-star restaurant, which later on I worked in for a while. But I fell in love with this area. It has a beautiful lake, and then it has the foothills of the mountains are lovely. And after we had spent, this was now late in the 70s, I guess maybe even the late, we spent some summers there and rented, and then finally decided, well, we should try to buy some land and build a chalet there, which we still have. Well, it was, as I said, when I was here, and Marcy would confirm that, I work all the time when I'm working, unless like we're going to go to New York this weekend. And so getting away, and we used to go there for a couple of months, essentially. And basically, we'd get on the plane. I would have a trunk with me with a bunch of papers and such. But sort of, you get on the plane, what you've forgotten, you've forgotten. And then a different life starts where in the morning you go down to the bakery, or you speak to the neighboring farmer about how his cows are doing, or whatever. I mean, it's just a different atmosphere. That also, so I think that was very good for me. I think it was fun for the children, and Marcy, and we did a lot of hiking and such. But also, I found that being under less pressure, I would work out some of my ideas and solve problems that I hadn't been able to solve while I was here. And, I asked my program director at NSF, you can take a summer salary. And my colleagues thought it was weird that I would go off like that, because although they travel probably almost as much as I do or more, but they do it, for 2 or 3 days, and they're worried that the research group wouldn't survive. But anyway, my program director asked him, look, this is what I do there, and I can show you these are the problems I've solved. And so he said, fine, you can take your summer salary. It's okay with me. I mean, he was also very well, it was very good. I said, there was a picture I wanted to buy and put in my office, and could I pay for it out of NSF funds? And he said, well, does it help you? I said, yep. And yeah, it was true, again, that I like to sit there and ever so often look up and look at the picture and sort of relax and clear my mind. And I don't know whether nowadays such things would happen. But so we were able to do it, and it was really a wonderful experience. We'd go hiking, we'd swim in the lake, you know, which is a beautiful lake, which also has an interesting story that it was very polluted because all the surrounding sort of tourist towns had all of their garbage and everything go into the lake, the sewers essentially. And then they decided as a group that they would build some sort of canalization to, you know, so no sewage went into the lake. And it had been, you know, polluted and, you know, was full of various weeds and such. And in about a year and a half, it was the cleanest lake in the Alps. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just recovered on its own. Now it's special that it has underground springs, so that made it all the more so. It has very little flow from, you know, rivers and such, and it really, and so it's a lovely place to swim. And so those really great summers. Once we lived in France most of the time, then we actually went there less, because you don't, so I mean, we could say, well, we can go there any time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't sort of say, well, we will go there. We still went there sometime in the summer a little bit, and in the winter, but much less so.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.